Yeah, guitar, bass, pedal steel, mandolin. It's all one instrument, you know, synthesizer. You know, it's a, you know, the recording studio. It's all whatever it takes to make the magic happen.
Welcome to the Banjo Studio Podcast from Banjo Studio, your source for the finest in North American made banjos and Collins guitars and mandolins. Go to banjostudio.com on the web for an incredible selection of instruments and accessories. Hello. In this episode, recorded August 5th, 2020, we're speaking with David Immergluck. David is best known for his contributions to The Counting Crows, Camper Van Beethoven, Monks of Doom, and John Hiatt.
The third mind thing just blew my mind.
Oh, cool. I'm really proud of that one. That's a fairly new thing that just came out. That came out on Valentine's Day, actually.
Wow. It's a phenomenon. I haven't heard anything that even sounds like that since... that wasn't made in 1968.
It's funny, you know, we made that record just the way I like, just sort of accidentally, you know what I mean? And I've got more responses like that, that you just gave me from that record than anything I've put out in the last 20 years. Just musician friends, it's like, oh my God, this is so cool. We were actually gonna tour at one point, but then the pandemic hit and I don't know what's gonna happen.
Well, hopefully you'll get to do that in the future. It was really, it's got a lot of things that pulled me in right away. I mean, you know, once you're doing Paul Butterfield things like that, I'm like, wow, you know, cause I've always been hot for Mike Bloomfield. So, you know,
hey, you too. I mean, I grew up with that. My brother record collection had one of the many things that was in there were the first two Butterfield Blues Band records. So yeah. I used to go listen to that shit when I was a kid, that particular recording was, we were just sort of experimentally getting together. I mean, Victor, the bass player I've been playing with for well over 30, I mean, since mid 80s, however long that's been, 35 years or whatever it's been. And you know, we've done so many, many different things together, but this was like, I knew Dave Alvin a little bit, you know, he toured with Camper Van Beethoven when I was touring with him. He was in Sid Straw's band. I knew the Blasters and all that shit, but I never really played music with him. But he and Victor were pretty tight over the last few years, and he wanted to do some improv stuff. And so Victor just, you know, called me. Dave wants to do some long form improv. I'm like, well, okay. He wants to step into our world. All right, cool. You know? And I've been doing a lot of stuff with the drummer, Michael Jerome, that guy plays with Richard Thompson. Mm-hmm. And he's just great, great drummer. So we just got together just experimentally on that first day. Okay, well, let's do a version of East West, you know? Uh-huh. And we wound up like cutting five versions of it. All 14 minutes long was the shortest version, wow. You know? And I was like, oh, this is kind of good. That was fun. This is going to work. They all sound good. They all sound different. Then we got together and just, you know, okay, how about this Alice Coltrane tune? How about this, how about a couple of vocal tunes? And then the next thing you know, there was a record done.
Yeah, it's astounding. And it sounds so good. I mean, just like even the whole recording thing, I mean, let alone the playing, which is...
all live, you know. No, I no headphones. It was really casual. It was a bizarre, it was in the studio that doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. Wow. But it was the first, we were the last thing to record in there, but it was the first recording studio in LA, and they used it for Foley for the first sound movies.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, Winslow Recording. And this guy, the guy who was running it, was sort of overseeing the Zappa audio estate, re-release estate. Wow. So he's responsible for all those Zappa re-releases, Mother's Invention things that have been coming out.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And so we recorded, and it was like a small studio. And then, you know, under the floor of the main room, which is about as big as my bedroom, where, you know, you could lift the floor up and there were like, all these different textures, gravel, cardboard, wood, you know, that they used to like walk on and record, do sound effects.
Wow.
You know, it was like this old, 1926 era, technology for recording sound effects.
Wow.
Still intact in the studio, but unfortunately, like so many things in LA, LA eats its own culture. That place is now non-existent.
Yeah, well, what an odd story to that record. To
yeah, isn't that funny?
I mean, you'll never get that sound again. That's it.
Well, also just the innocence of like not knowing we were making a record. There's something to that too, you know?
Right, yeah.
Oh, this is fun. Oh, let's do this. And then, oh, God, my God, we got a record here. And then all of a sudden, like, oh, Yep Rock was all about it. And next thing you know, it's coming out.
Yeah. Well, it's not surprising. It's a great lineup, too. I mean, you know, Dave Allen, I also know from the Blasters and stuff.
Yeah, it's cool. He's a great guitar player. Great guy, too.
Absolutely. So it's been real interesting listening to you over that many years. And I guess there's a long thread that ties things together, but I sort of wanted to go to...
Please explain it to me.
You start off from up there, right? You're from
I was born and raised Berkeley, California, a rare native.
You know? Right. What happened? How did you get into music up there? I mean,
I was born in 1961, so I have an older brother, 7 years older than me. He was in a band in high school in the late 60s, that probably sounded like the Butterfield Blues Band or the Yardbirds or something, you know. And he doesn't play anymore, but I got all my early, just got the bug from my older brother. His band would rehearse in our living room. And, well, actually, they rehearsed once in our living room. This has got to be like 1968 or something, so I'm like 7 years old. Uh-huh. Some weird PA system. My brother was played electric bass, and my mother was freaking out, there was, it was the era of early drugs, and my brother was going to the Fillmore all the time, and underaged, and like handed Fillmore posters out for Bill Graham. So he had this enormous collection of the classic Fillmore posters all over his bedroom wall. So it was like always this magic kingdom for me, his room. And but anyway, I digress. They were rehearsing in the living room this one time, and it was loud as fuck, And my mom was freaking out, and she just sort of like blockaded my bedroom door, which was at the other end of the hallway, and wouldn't let me through. Because she was afraid my ears were going to get damaged by this loud music coming out happening in the living room, and she was just blocked me. And I was like, I was like, she wouldn't let me through. And my mom was a big Amazon woman, and it just like, it fucking like, I can't go in that. I am definitely going in that room. And I've been trying to get in that room for the last 50, 60 years.
Well,
there it is,
Wow. That's amazing. Okay. Yeah. So from being disallowed, it was something.
Exactly. I was like, oh, I got to do that. And it's like, oh, my brother started taking me to concerts at an early age. And then I was, by the time I got into, when I hit fifth grade, I ran into some friends at my school who my best friend and his older brother already had a band. And I'm like, fuck, wow, that looks fun. It was sixth grade. And so my older brother's girlfriend gave me a guitar, and I was in that band summer between sixth and seventh grade.
Uh-huh. And how was it learning guitar? Did you just work it all out yourself, or did you have people show
you? Well, honestly, in second grade, I had classical piano lessons for about 2 years. Uh-huh. And then I quit. I didn't really like it. I didn't really like it. And I had my grandmother, bless her heart, was very strict with me about it and would like keep me from going outside and playing. You got to practice your piano. She'd stand over me with a ruler, slap my hands if I was playing wrong. So it was like, eventually I was like, I'm not doing this, So fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, I wasn't really playing an instrument, but then I got the rock and roll bug. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in there, and my brother's girlfriend gave me this guitar, and I got a couple of guitar. I took guitar lessons right then for just rudimentary for about a couple of months, and eventually the guitar teacher was teaching me some stuff, basic chords, but then I was sort of you know, I wanted to learn, you know, Rolling Stones songs or whatever it was I was listening to at the time, Beatles songs. And I'd try and figure them out and bring them to him. And eventually, you know, he wasn't teaching me what I wanted to learn. And I was, I taught myself how to learn off records, you know?
Great.
And then I just did that for, you know, 5-6 years. I was playing in bands, or in this one band. I was always in this band and just learning off records. And then somewhere in late high school, it was like the 10th or 11th grade, I was already going to concerts and sneaking into clubs. And I saw this band at our local club, Keystone Berkeley. And it was, they were called Khartoum with an M. And they were, you know, sort of a prog rock band at the time. This is the late 70s. Uh-huh. Snuck into the club underage. It was summer between 11th and 12th grade is exactly when it was. And the guitar player was just fucking killer, full Steve Howe, you know? And so I went up to him after. I hadn't had a guitar teacher in, you know, 6 years, maybe longer, whatever, you know, we're 11th grade now. And yeah, 5 years. I'd done 5 years of just learning on my own. And I asked him if he'd give me some guitar lessons. And that just in that summer, it was just for 3 months. I studied with this guy, Joseph Delia, who wound up I see his name on movie credits as a, you know, composer now.
Really?
But weirdly. But now, but I was really lucky to get with him, and he hit me to the whole modal concept, at which I still mull over, you know? You know, and also finger picking. Those are the two main things I got from him. And, you know, he gave me all this information in this short period of time. I'd had all this time learning on my own for 5 years. And I just got with this guy at the right time. And, you know, I had all these questions. He had all the answers. He gave names to the things that I thought I was doing that were wrong. you know, and made me realize, oh, they're not wrong. They're just this other thing. And I'm still mulling over that stuff now. And that's got to be like 1977, 78. I'm still mulling over those 3 months, you know?
Yeah, wow. So
I was just really fortunate for me. My brain was at the right time. You know, as Jim Morrison says, the fragile eggshell mind. I had been mulling over stuff for years and playing in band the entire time as well, you know, playing in this rock band. And so applying it, you know? And then being able to, you know. So anyway, that's real early. That's how I got into music, I guess.
Yeah, that's really cool. And then, but it seems like, so when was your first, like, you know, real thing where you were gigging out, where you were performing for people?
Well, that particular band that I, you know, joined in seventh grade, we kept it going all through high school. And then I went to UC Santa Cruz, and so did some of the other guys. And we kept the band going all through that too, all through college. Changed its name a couple of times. So, but you know,
what year were you in Santa Cruz?
Let's see. I went down there in 79.
Okay.
And I left in 84.
Right when I was I moved there in 84. That's really interesting.
Did you really? Did
you? Yeah.
Did we talk about this? You went to UC Santa Cruz?
I didn't actually go to UC Santa Cruz. I was at Cabrillo College.
I went to Cabrillo. I went to UC and Cabrillo. Cabrillo was actually, I got more out of Cabrillo musically.
You know? I can.
There was a great electronic music course there. This guy named Bob Beatty. Yeah. I got a lot out of that. Yeah.
That's interesting. And I remember, I mean, it's funny because it came up yesterday as I was reading about Mushroom and that it had Graham Khanna in it. And I knew those guys. Certainly, I knew Khanna.
Oh, Graham was part of the whole Santa Cruz, you know, fringe camper van Beethoven scene.
Exactly. And the Wrestling Worms, which is
Wrestling Worms. There you go. I didn't realize you had that connection. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was really interesting reading that. And then I was looking at, you know, which was actually the first time I saw it. Eugene Chadbourne.
Oh yeah, sure.
Was playing with them.
I have hilarious Eugene stories.
I was about to get to that because then it was Camper. So let me see here. So you had your band all through college. When did you end up with Camper Van Beethoven?
Well, that's years later.
Years later.
Yeah. Oh, I left Santa Cruz and still, you know, I was I was not making a living as a musician, but I'd left because I realized I got to get out of this town, you know. And at the, you know, at the time, San Francisco was the big city, you know. I got to get back up to the Bay Area and, like, I'm going to be a fucking musician. I'm going to and figure out how to do it. Because I'm not getting anywhere here in Santa Cruz, you know.
Sure.
And so I left, but Chris Peterson, the drummer for Camper Van Beethoven and the drummer for Monks of Doom as well, we went to college together at UC Santa Cruz. And even then, he was just an exceptional drummer. It was like, he was a very Bill Bruford, Van der Graaf generator. You know, the day I met him, he was on campus wearing a Brand X t-shirt, if you know that band. And it's like, okay, you know, when you're in college, you wear these signifiers to let people know who you are. So he was wearing Brand X. I was like, oh, this guy knows Brand X. All right. So we hit it off. And then over the years in Santa Cruz, going through college, like, eventually my band was popular. And when people wanted to make, you know, rudimentary amateur recordings, my first forays in the recording studio, they'd hire me to play guitar. And usually Chris Peterson would be on those sessions too. Cause if you wanted a good drummer, you would get Chris to come play on your recording. Uh-huh. So he and I would wind up, we knew each other, but we would wind up doing these weird recordings, you know, in Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh.
So when I moved back up to the Bay Area, I sort of stayed in touch with Chris, you know. Uh-huh. You know, I'm going up to the big city to make it. So he wanted to see how I did up in the big city. It's funny saying that now, because I shake my fist at San Francisco now, because there's really kind of no music scene there anymore.
Right.
But I'm talking mid 80s. It was pretty.
Yeah.
It was pretty. In fact, it was a very fertile time right then.
Oh yeah.
In the Bay Area, for music. Anyway, I went up there and Chris stayed in Santa Cruz, and he would periodically he'd come stay with me up in the Bay Area, and he'd come up for the weekend and we'd go see shows. I mean, he came up one time and we went and saw The Residents, and you know, a couple of other times, you know, if anything interesting was happening, he'd come up. And you know, periodically I'd call him and go, hey, what's going on down in Santa Cruz, you know. And you know, nothing would be going on down there. And I was like, oh God, I'm glad I moved up to the Bay Area. I was playing in all these bands, slugging it out, playing in the clubs, saying yes to everybody, you know, and trying to make something happen. And one time I call Chris and you know, I'd call him every 6 weeks. Hey, what's going on? How's Santa Cruz? You know, this one time I call him and he's like, ah, man, it's a scandal. It's embarrassing. There's this fucking band down here, Camper Van Beethoven. They don't have any songs. They take one riff from a song and then they say it's their song. And everyone freaks out. Everyone loves them. It just makes me sick. I'm like, you know, I'm going to start holding the phone away from my ear. I'm like, oh, geez, yeah, okay, all right. You know, hang up. I'm like, God damn, I'm glad I don't live in Santa Cruz anymore.
It's hard because I probably sounded exactly like him when I was in Santa Cruz. Like, what are people listening to this band for?
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure. You know, and then, you know, sure enough, 6 weeks later, I call up Chris, you know, and I'm like, hey, how's it going down in Santa Cruz? And there's silence, and then it's like, I'm going on tour with Camper Van Beethoven. I've joined Camper Van Beethoven and I'm going on tour. It's like, going on tour? Whoa, we never heard of that. Going on tour, that was insane. Uh-huh. The concept, you know? And then sure enough, they were on college radio all the time. You know, the Take the Skinheads Bowling had kind of hit. And they were coming up and playing shows in San Francisco. And sure enough, I went and saw them play at this really shitty club in Haight Street. And Chris was embarrassed, you know, but I'm watching them and I love them. I was like, this band is incredible. It's like, they're like the Mothers of Invention with Ian Hunter as their singer or something. It's like this weird, you know, just totally chaotic, fantastic hodgepodge of stuff and very different than what was going on at the time. Yeah. Because at the time in San Francisco, everyone wanted to sound like the Stooges.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that was it, you know. And nothing, we all love the Stooges, but that's all anybody was doing. So anything different than that really stuck out, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know,
What a
I gave Camper the thumbs up, and
yeah, that's fan great
for a long time. You know,
you have such a great range of styles, ways of playing guitar that you and mandolin. I was surprised at how much mandolin work you do, really anything with strings. And I'm wondering how you got in those directions. Obviously, you're into Camper Van Beethoven, so that's
well. Actually, when I in '89, I finally, and Monks of Doom had been going for a long time already, and put out a couple of records. But I was, you know, whenever Camper came through San Francisco, I would always be at the shows, and you know, I was going out to see live, and sometimes they would stay at my, I was living at my mother's house at the time, and some, you know, pretty big house, bands would come through, they'd stay at our house, you know, and Camper were always family, so a bunch of them would stay. I was just part of that Camper family, and by 1989, David Lowery, there was a shakeup in Camper. Jonathan had left. The violin player, and they got this new violin player, Morgan, and Lowry called me up and asked me if I would come on tour with them and play like pedal steel, which I barely knew how to play. I'd done some recording with it and, you know, maybe some guitar and a couple songs, and you know, we'll see what happens. I'm just like, to go on tour, fuck yes, because as far as I'd gone, you got to understand, being in a band in San Francisco or in the Bay Area, to go on tour, well, you could go to LA or you could go north and go up into Colorado. You could hit, you know, the next city that you would go to from, you know, Sacramento would be Portland, Oregon, and then Seattle. And then if you're lucky, you know, you could cross over and go play Vancouver in Canada. And that's just like north, south. But, and maybe San Diego, you go LA and maybe San Diego if you had enough juice. But to go east, well, that's a big journey. You're not really hitting any kind of town worthwhile until you hit Colorado. You got to get over the Rockies. And then it's a long way to the next town too. Mm-hmm. It's not like being, you know, even growing up in, I don't know if you grew up in New Orleans, but you know, living in New Orleans, you can go to Alabama, you can go to Mississippi, you can go to Texas pretty easily.
Yeah.
You know? And on the East Coast, I trip on the people. And I'm talking about kids who are in their, you know, bands and their teams and stuff. They're able to just go, oh, from Boston to New York, no problem, you know?
Yeah, right.
There's just so, everything's so much closer together. On the West Coast, it's like, it's expansive. And that Midwest chunk where nothing's going on, that's a lot of driving. Yeah. So, you know, pre-internet, you know, you had to have some juice to be able to get east from the West Coast. So I got this opportunity from Camper, you know, Lowry calls me and says, you want to go on tour? I was like, fuck yes, I'm gonna go to all these places I've never been, you know. And also, you know, I've never really been on tour. I'd only been up the coast, and that was it, you know. So
What was it like?
No, I guess it's a long way of saying I joined, and then there was a mandolin floating around, and I just like, oh well, if I learn how to play this, I can play on more songs on the show. You know, it just sort of like, oh, okay. You know, and just sort of like, you know, oh yeah, maybe I'll play pedal. I was going to play pedal steel on only this one song, but maybe it can fit on this other song. And I'm sort of learning on the job, you know?
Wow.
And then eventually it was like, oh, you know, you know, I mean, years later, it's sort of like, yeah, guitar, bass, pedal steel, mandolin, it's all one instrument, you know, synthesizer. Wow. You know, it's a, you know, the recording studio, it's all whatever it takes to make the magic happen.
So as far as the session things, well, obviously, did you like being on the road? Obviously, you must like being on the road. I mean, you're
it's not for everybody, but I love it. You know,
yeah.
I love traveling, and I really love going overseas. I remember, you know, the first time going to Europe with Camper Van Beethoven was the first time I'd ever been. I've been to Europe with my family. We lived in Europe for a year when I was really young. We lived in Florence. My dad was teaching over there.
Oh, yeah.
And so I just like, you know, just traveling, and particularly traveling in alien environments, is sort of in my bones. So I like being on the road. I know a lot of people don't, because it's the traveling itself can be exhausting, and the disorientation is exhausting too. But, you know, you get addicted to changing your environment on a daily basis.
Yeah,
you know, sure. I like it. And so like when I'm at home for a long period of time, I sort of go crazy. Sort of why I live in two cities. I live in LA and I live in New York, because I can only be in one place for 6 weeks before I start, you know, climbing the walls and going, I got to get out of here.
Did you now let me see the Monks of Doom thing though. You were doing that before Camper Van Beethoven.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And that's basically with Camp. That is Camper Van Beethoven.
It is. It was a offshoot of Camper Van Beethoven. Yeah.
And how would you describe what the different musics were?
Well, it was just much more, you know, unironically, you know, King Crimson. There's no irony to the reference. Like Camper had a very like, oh, you know, in the middle of a song, they go, play the Aqualung lick. You know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Isn't that funny? Jethro Tull, aren't they a joke? But Monks of Doom was more like, you know, we're playing the intro to Yours Is No Disgrace by Yes, tapping that onto one of our other songs. And like, there's no irony there. We love this thing, you know? There's no like, hey, isn't this, or weren't they stupid? Yes. No, yes, we're really cool, actually. Mm-hmm. That'd be the biggest difference with Monks of Doom. And, you know, just sort of slightly more chops oriented, just more, you know, all I can say is post-punk prog rock is really what it was, and what it still is.
Let me try to get into your interest in playing that music. I mean, I want to get into something because you're a really flexible guitar player, especially for doing things that.
Well, I'm just a fan. I'm a fan of music, and before anything, I'm a record collector. Again, what I got from my older brother, you know, stealing records from his record collection. Then eventually it's like, wow, you know, my record collection lives in two different cities. It's vast, and I keep adding to it. And I just like a lot of music, and, you know, it just sort of seeps in after a while, you know. There's so many different ways to skin a fish, you know? Uh-huh. And I mean, at my age, you know, there was a time when I only tried to play one kind of music, you know, and was sort of like almost Nazi about it. Like, oh, it has to be, you know, really difficult to play and multi-time signatures and.
Oh, really? You know, did that?
What's that?
You were like that? When was that?
That would be our early Monks of Doom. And you know, pop songs is not cool, you know. Mm. But you know, you get into your late 50s and if you're still playing music, well, there's just so many different approaches, you know. Uh-huh. And you know, what's, you know, Bob Dylan. You know, what's wrong with that?
Absolutely nothing for me. this brings up an interesting thing because, I mean, I understand from your story in relation to, I mean, you play with one of the biggest pop bands that there was in the 90s, you know, what seems to be the tail end of big recording contract stuff and everything. But you didn't do that right away. You were still playing with these bands and as I understand, doing a lot of session work. So
it all kind of blurs together because, you know, Monks of Doom, Adam's been a friend of mine since pre all of that.
Right.
And Monks of Doom rehearsed at Adam's house. Uh-huh. You know?
And this is the Northwest connection I was talking about. He's from up there.
Yeah. You wouldn't, there's a time when you wouldn't put Monks of Doom and Counting Crows together, you know. That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, wow, that's, you know, and it's still that way, you know, up in the Bay Area. It's funny. Counting Crows is a really funny, case study, particularly in the Bay Area, because they were always regarded as not being cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was people when Counting Crows got signed, you know, by a major label in 93, mm-hmm. backlash on the street was harsh enough to make Adam like not, he had to leave.
Wow.
He had to leave San Francisco. And it is still that way up there. I mean, there's still people in the, and I put quotes on it, music press, unquote, of San Francisco who still, they just can't say a nice thing about Counting Crows, you know, uh-huh. always, you know, this, yeah, you know, we hate them so much. Yeah, they were really good the other night, but, you know, hate to admit it, you know. Or something, you know, it's just so funny. And for me, it's like, you know, it was a funny thing, you know, like there was, like I was involved in the Counting Crows first record and Adam asked me to join right then. Mm-hmm. And I didn't for various reasons. And, which even baffle me at this point, but, you know, in San Francisco, after word got around, oh, Immer Gluck didn't join Counting Crows. This is before the record came out. And then the record came out, it was humongoloid. And I'd get all these people coming up to me, man, that's so cool that you didn't join. You know, it's like, what? Wow. What do you mean it's cool that I didn't join? What the fuck do you care? And why do you have an opinion? And, you know, you have no idea why I didn't join at that time. You know, it was like, you know, it was just a really interesting, it really got me thinking. And then shortly after that, I wound up playing with John Hiatt. And that's sort of when my mind opened up to other, you know, other ways of doing music other than it had to be Captain Beefheart all the time.
You know? Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. So here, let's get into that a little bit. How did you end up with John Hiatt?
Again, a drummer, you know, and it was a drummer in San Francisco, this guy, Michael Urbano, another outstanding drummer. He and I wound up on some sessions together in San Francisco for, if I'm not mistaken, Chuck Prophet, if you know who that is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Wow. As we were making, we were on some Chuck Prophet recording sessions together and he just made a note of me. And then he was, not long after that, he was playing in Cracker,
wow,
which was post Camper Van Beethoven. You know, that was Camper Van Beethoven broke up, and Monks of Doom went full force, and Cracker went full force. Oh. Basically, what happened there for many years, and he wound up playing in Cracker.
Interesting.
And then he left Cracker, took the bass player, and they went and played with John Hiatt. And then John Hiatt was guitar player left and they needed a guitar player. And Michael remembered me from the session and thought, how about this guy? You know, and, you know, just from staying busy, I guess, is how I got that gig, you know?
So this is an interesting thing.
Word of mouth, you know?
Again, I listened to three records that you were on with John Hiatt recently, you know, in the last few days. And they're so different from each other. Again, there's a range. I mean, they're consistent within themselves as records, but the styles are really different. And I'm thinking, well, you know, for some reason in my head, it had been years since I've heard John Hiatt, but I think I had not associated him with that wide range of approaches to the writing and all of that. And so what was that like? I mean, how did
I mean, what do you mean by that? Because I listen to John and it all sounds like John to me.
Oh, no, it sounds like him. That's not what I'm getting at. But, you know, one of the records was, I wouldn't say it was like, wasn't post disco, but it was funky. It was like a funky thing and had a whole lot of electric band stuff going on it. And
that must be Little Song, Little Head.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And then there's that one that you actually really recommended, which I got to say is really, I really, really love the record.
I love that record because of its purity. That one's all acoustic for the most part. With
the other one, the Muddy Water one. Which
Crossing Muddy Waters, yeah.
Amazing. But they're very different records.
Yeah, though, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was the mid to late 90s and there was big budgets and there was a lot of production going on and there was MTV and, you know, big record label production. That's all I can say. And that's why I love Crossing Muddy Waters so much, because it was like, fuck all that. You know, we made that record in 3 days and it was done. And
all of your stuff made me want to play acoustic guitar again, actually, a lot more than I
always did. Always a good thing to do. I'll tell you what, during this pandemic, you know, I'm talking about, I was talking earlier about, you know, I can't be anywhere longer than 6 weeks without crawling out of my own skin. I've been in my New York apartment since mid-February and haven't left. It's turned out to be really wonderful, actually, but I could not have survived without my acoustic guitar.
Right.
Just sitting on the couch and just, you know, using that. It's amazing. I feel sorry for people who don't have actually that outlet just to play music by yourself, because it's a wonderful thing about acoustic guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. So what do you do? Are you writing, or how do you, I mean, let's talk about how you get to have such a range. I mean, do you feel like you really, your whole facility you've learned from learning music that you've loved off of records, or is there a way that you deal with it within yourself, or is there a writing direction or some sort of composing momentum, or how do you, let's say you're by yourself working, has it always been that you work a certain way with the instrument, or?
Never a certain way, but I will say that my biggest success is when I get out of my own way. Uh-huh. And the less I think about it, the better. And, you know, I used to have a handheld cassette recorder that if, you know, I'm sitting around just playing guitar to myself and I like that. Oh, good. Immediately record the snippet of an idea. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. I do it now with voice memo on my iPhone.
Sure.
And, you know, catching those spontaneous ideas, I've got bags and bags and bags of cassettes and, files and files and files and files of little voice memos. And sometimes they turn into songs. Sometimes they turn into parts of songs.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I forget about them for years and years and resuscitate them.
Amazing.
But honestly, you know, the less I self-consciously think about writing or recording or playing, I seem to be having more and more success with that. I was joking about this with some people that I play with in LA not long. It was after that Mushroom record that I sent you, actually. That record was Counting Crows. It was one of the last shows Counting Crows played last year. Mm-hmm. It was a big festival in San Francisco. And we were playing in the middle of the day. And my friend who runs Mushroom had booked a show in San Francisco at that place, the Makeout Room. Uh-huh. And I promise you the story will hopefully mean something, for the same day, you know, for the same night later that night. And in my mind, you know, the prankster in me was like, I'm going to fucking play the Counting Crows show. And then I'm going to get in a cab and I'm going to go play this show with no preparation at this club in San Francisco as well later that night. You know, I know, you know what I'm talking about. Multi-gig night. Come on, man.
Yeah. We do that all the time. Yeah.
Of course. And you know, you start taking pride in being able to do that. And,
uh-huh.
and Mushroom, that particular band is, I've played many gigs with Mushroom since it sort of resuscitated itself I helped revive it in Los Angeles, because the main guy, Pat Thomas, moved from San Francisco. It was a San Francisco band, and the main guy moved to LA. And he and I started hanging out again. I knew him from San Francisco. I was like, oh, let's do Mushroom in LA. And every time you do a Mushroom gig, you don't know who's going to show up, who's, you know, what the lineup is going to. One time DJ Bonebreak from X showed up, but playing vibraphone. Wow. Turns out he's a virtuoso vibes player. Uh-huh. But you know what I mean? It's like, oh, maybe there's going to be three electric guitars. Maybe it's going to be three bass players. And, oh, there's two keyboard players today. Oh, there's a guy playing pedal steel through all these effects. You know, never know. And there's no material. And it's just like, get up and just invent a set of music. And so this was going to be the same thing this night in San Francisco last year. But it was a reunion of a bunch of members from the San Francisco contingent of Mushroom, right? Uh-huh. And actually Victor as well from Monks of Doom and Camper was now doing, he'd moved to LA and gotten him involved in Mushroom down there a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it was going to be with mostly people I hadn't played with, but Victor and I had done a bunch of Monks of Doom shows earlier that month. And I just left him with some of my gear and just like, have this at the Mushroom show in San Francisco so that I can just go roll from the Counting Crows show and just show up at the club, plug in, and we're going. Because uh-huh. It was going to be tight schedule, mm-hmm. You know. And long story short, this comes to pass. County Crows, we had a great, great, great show that day. It was quite, it was really hard for me to find a cab, but out of Golden Gate Park and get down into the Mission to this club. But miraculously I got there and the band was already on stage. I jumped on stage and sure enough, Victor had set my pedal board up. So I just like literally just plugged my guitar and we just started. Uh-huh. And that's that set of music. And afterwards, and it was being recorded too, as well, obviously. You know, better than most Mushroom gigs. We always try and record, but this time there was like multi-track shit going on. So a couple weeks later, get the tracks back, and Pat from Mushroom and I are, we got to put this thing out. This thing is awesome. And I'm listening to it. I'm going, there was no pre-composition to anything. It was just completely free form off the top of the head. Mm-hmm. And this set of music just sort of like, Aphrodite hath sprung forth from the head of Zeus, you know, like crack the skull and point, this thing pops out. I'm like, wow, it's so wonderful. And I find that when I go into the studio now, it's better if the less prepared I am, the more the recording is going to like it. Which isn't a lazy way of saying, oh yeah, don't have to, you have to always, you know, you live your life preparing to play music, but you know, I don't want to sweat about what guitar part I'm going to play, you know, for hours and hours before I go into the recording studio. I want to go in and discover it while the tape is rolling, or while the hard drive is spinning, or while whatever device is capturing the thing. You want to have the spontaneousness. And look, I've been reading musicians talking about this forever, but it's really come to pass for me now that, like, wow, the less forethought, the more I like it, the more I like the recording, you know, and then eventually it's like, well, where am I heading? You know, I'm eventually heading to just one note, the ohm, you know, and like I sent you that Monks of Doom live playing Four Immer, which is just like basically a jam on one chord for 11 minutes, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah. And you know, it's like, oh, one chord, yeah, that's the whole krautrock, you know, motoric beat on one chord. It's like the ohm of music, you know, like, oh, I'm heading towards one note, and then eventually I'm heading towards the dial tone on the phone, you know, and then finally I'm heading to the flat line.
Wow, that's the way to think of it. Great.
That's the ultimate musical final conclusion, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Final note.
Yeah. This is an amazing thing because, I mean, several times you said, I mean, when you were describing seeing all the instruments as one instrument and all of that stuff, it seems like, you're, I mean, I'm wondering, I mean, this has to be, well, you're so flexible, and I keep saying this, but I mean, it seems like there's no preference for you either, whether it's the studio or live or just working with
people. Well, I love them both. I love them both, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's comfortable.
I try to bring the mind of both of those, either of those, to the other thing. Definitely uh-huh. try and bring the mind of live to the studio, which uh-huh. is kind of what I was talking about, I guess. A long way of saying exactly that. You know, the studio, and I've been on both sides of the glass, you know, like all through the 80s. When I moved up to San Francisco in the mid 80s, I went and studied recording at SF State.
Oh yeah.
And then I had a recording studio with a bunch of friends. So I was, you know, engineering and producing while playing in all these bands, you know, mm-hmm. And eventually there was a time when there's like, either you're going on tour or you're staying in the studio. And I was like, well, I really want to play live. You know, I really like playing live, you know. Uh-huh. So I just sort of, you know, chased that down. But had a lot of experience on the other side of the glass, and I still exercise that now. But it's when I was producing that I really came to the realization of, oh, it's all one instrument,
uh-huh.
you know, and it's just music.
Uh-huh.
You know, and, you know, a lot of people know me as a multi-instrumentalist. I'm a multi-instrumentalist from Counting Crows. I was a multi-instrumentalist with John Hiatt. Oh, you're a multi-instrumentalist, you know. So people ask me, what do you play? I don't say I'm a multi-instrumentalist. I will say I'm a guitar player. Mm-hmm. You know, I started on guitar, and it all comes from that. Mm-hmm. You
know? I want to talk since on the guitar. The sounds are extremely rich and very juicy that you got, and so there. I feel like there must yet be something that you're really looking for.
My lizard brain has to go, oh, I like that, you know. Uh-huh. And it's from being a, you know, I've been listening to records since I was a kid, and I know what I like. I don't like bad guitar tones. Yeah. And so.
How would you describe a good guitar tone?
Peter Green.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Good electric guitar tone. He had a good acoustic guitar. Burt Jansch, great acoustic guitar tone.
Oh yeah, that's a
good. Richard Thompson, great guitar tones. I don't know. I really for okay. I could tell you about record. I mean, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out by the Rolling Stones. That was a record I had early on, and I just learned every lick on that record. Yeah. Both guitar players, and like I like all that shit. Keith Richards, you know, but yeah. Mick Taylor on that record,
love the Mick Taylor,
great guitar tone. You know, Can't You Hear Me Knocking? The guitar solo on that, right? You know, I grew up with Santana, saw Santana many times as a kid. You know, there's another good guitar tone.
Wonderful, classic.
You know, but you know, Peter Green just died last week, so I've been sort of immersed in him a little bit lately, and. Actually, I have one of my guitars here in New York is this gold top Les Paul, and I had my friend wired up Peter Green style. Do you know what that is?
No, talk about that.
Oh, that's really cool. That's a really cool thing. And most people don't know what the actual effect is, but his Les Paul, two humbucker pickups, but accidentally the neck pickup was upside down. So the pole pieces were towards the bridge, you know.
Wow.
And it was also wired out of phase with the other humbucker, which is not how Les Pauls are wired. So you go in the middle position and suddenly it's like this super thin, you know, strat out of phase tone on this Les Paul. It's like, what the fuck, you know? And you know, if you move one of the volumes, either one, just ever so slightly, the tone just goes, it just like morphs, you know, it just mutates really quickly.
Wow.
It gets thick really fast, or, you know, just it changes around just by fucking around with the volume controls of the pickups, because the amount of phase that it's out of changes.
Wow.
Because of the volume of one of the pickups. So it's very peculiar to humbucker pickups being out of phase. Yeah. And so anyway, you know, most people go, oh, the Peter Green tone, and they think of, you know, his super meaty, beautiful B.B. King guitar tone that he gets. Mm-hmm. B.B. King, another great guitar tone. Yeah.
That's good.
But the thing about the Peter Green out of phase wiring that everyone, you know, talks about, oh, that, you know, that's so special about the Peter Green Les Paul, is this actually really super thin, you know, wimpy tone that he would use in these really great ways if you study him, like, you know, in a blues tune. There's this tune called Jumping at Shadows that I love that's on, there's this live record that they recorded right before he left. Mm-hmm. And it's been widely bootlegged and then released, you know, three CDs worth of this shit from the Boston Tea Party. It's one of my favorite live recordings. Mm-hmm. But there's a song on there, Jumping at Shadows, this blues tune. And, you know, in the middle, he takes this very B.B. King-esque guitar solo and it climaxes really heavy like only he can. And then right at the peak, he flips into the, you know, the dynamic just goes, sucks down. And, you know, he flips the pickup into that middle position and it's whop, it's super tiny. Mm-hmm. And that's what that Peter Green wiring does.
Interesting.
He uses it that way to get real quiet. Most people don't know that. They think, oh, the Peter Green wiring, it's that big fat sound that he gets. But uh-huh. It's exactly the opposite.
Uh-huh. So it's a middle position thing. It's
a middle position out of phase thing. So it's really fun to play around with if you know that. But anyway, I digress. I'm like sort of geeking on it because I just did it to this guitar and I've been listening to those recordings again. And oh, there he's using that tone right there. Oh, you could pick it out once you know what it is.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you know about that guitar, but it's famously got, Gary Moore got it and had it for decades and decades. Uh-huh. And he was a friend of Peter Green's. And then now Kirk Hammett of Metallica owns that particular.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now this is interesting. I mean, I was looking at your incredibly, you know, it makes me drool is your great guitar collection and amp collection, at least what's listed online, things that I can see.
What's listed online, because I had to you know, make a itinerary of all my gear for insurance reasons this year. And I got a lot of fucking guitars, man.
Yeah. And the amps and that, and then even what people list as your pedals, which of course shows up on Geek Boards. It may or may not be true, but it was,
tell me what you were geeking on and I'll tell you if it's even correct.
Well, no, but let's just pause there at the gold top that you're talking about. Is that the gold top? I was seeing a gold top that didn't have the wide humbuckers, had the narrow humbuckers. And is that the one you rewired to look like?
No, this is, and that's not a, that's a, what you're talking about is a Les Paul Deluxe. It has the mini humbuckers, which has sort of been my main Counting Crows guitar since I've been there. Uh-huh. I've used that on a lot of stuff and it just seems to cut really well with some of the Crows songs. And now I've got several different Les Paul Deluxes.
Uh-huh.
But no, the Les Paul I'm talking about is a regular, you know, it's actually it was a 2000 reissue of a 1957 gold top Les Paul. Uh-huh. So it's a, you know, stop tail piece and two humbuckers.
Oh, beautiful.
And that particular guitar, I've put it through many changes. I've had shaved the neck down. I broke the headstock on it, had that repaired. It's been through a million different.
A nice tortured Les Paul. Great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. but my main axe right now is that white SG custom from 68 that I got accidentally. And I've had most of the stuff on The Third Mind is that guitar. Uh-huh. Everything on the latest Counting Crows is that guitar.
Uh-huh.
Bunch of stuff on the Monks of Doom. It's my main Monks of Doom guitar now. It's a really fantastic axe. I'll tell you, you ever hear the band Man?
No.
Oh, you got to get into them. Yeah, M-A-N.
I'll check it out.
They're a Welsh band from the 70s.
Oh, yeah?
They're from Wales, but they worshipped Quicksilver Messenger Service.
I love that band.
Yeah.
When I was a kid.
Oh, Quicksilver?
Yeah, I was really into that when I was a teenager, man. That was just worth it.
But, well, there's this one Man record that we were all really into in high school. They, for some reason, they were really popular in the Bay Area, and they came through a lot.
Huh.
Man. And they played Keystone Berkeley all the time, and I saw them actually open up for Todd Rundgren this one time. So I was a fan of Man, and all the stoners were into them. And there's this record called Rhinos, Winos, and Lunatics, right?
Okay.
And there's a song on there called Kerosene, I want to say. Just one of my favorite guitar solos, you know?
Wow.
And I hadn't listened to the record in a long time. And for some reason, I was sort of freaking out on Man about 5 years ago, and I was going back into their records, and I hadn't listened to them in a long time. I listened to that album, and that song comes up, and the guitar solo comes up on it, and I'm like, every fucking idea I thought was original to me that I ever had recording a guitar solo is in that guitar solo.
Mm.
You know, there's not one original idea do I have. It's all in that one guitar solo, man. And so, okay, so now, and it's like, who is it? It's this guy, Mickey Jones, man.
Huh.
You know, there's these two guitar players, Deke Leonard, Mickey Jones. Like, Mickey Jones, what a great axe player. He played SG. You know, a couple of years later, Counting Crows are playing in London. And after I've had this revelation, and I've, you know, after that, I was just like religiously listening again to Man all the time, listening to all the records I didn't know from before, listening to them chronological, listening to bootlegs. It's like, I'm the Man guy. And we're going to play at the Roundhouse.
Oh yeah. Well, but
you know, in London, they refurbished the Roundhouse, and Counting Crows were going to play there two nights, right? Uh-huh. And now the Roundhouse back in the 70s was sort of man's home court, sort of like Winterland for the Grateful Dead.
I was there in the 70s. You know, I grew up in London, so this is why I struck.
Oh, right on. I didn't know you. God, see, I should be interviewing you.
Well, then we'll save
that's
that
for another day. That's for another day. We'll do that. We'll do that next time. But anyway, you'll appreciate this because look, I'm a superstitious person. We play music as a, not just for a living, but as a vocation and as a lifestyle. And you have to, you know, to do music properly, you have to be sort of tap into the supernatural a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, especially if you're into any kind of improvisation, you're tapping into some invisible forces. Okay. So I consider myself, you know, I have to have a bit of clairvoyance maybe. And, you know, I like to say clairvoyance runs in my family. My mother's kind of clairvoyant. Uh-huh. And I just think it helps with music. But anyway, I'm just saying I'm superstitious. So we're playing at the Roundhouse. And I'm like, and Mickey Jones, this guitar player from Man, had died like 3 months earlier, you know, a year, not too long ago. Okay. Uh-huh. And I'm working myself up into a frenzy for the week before. We're on tour in Europe, but we're playing the Roundhouse, and I'm whipping out the Man recorder. They're like, we're playing their Man's home court, man. And fucking Mickey Jones is the, you know, author of that guitar solo that changed my life. And that any original idea I've ever thought I had was from that one Mickey Jones guitar solo, right? Mm-hmm. Working myself up for a week and a half before we get to the show. And you know, we're playing the show, and Counting Crows does very well in London. We got two sold out shows at the Roundhouse, and I'm fucking in seventh heaven. And you know, we come to some song that I'm playing a guitar solo in, and I just get emotional, and I'm holding the guitar over my head and playing with one hand kind of trip, and I'm just like I'm hallucinated that like fucking Mickey Jones is in the room, and he's hovering over, you know, the round ceiling, you know, and it was sort of like, you know, I described it as a, you know, seeing ghosts, but it was like a tungsten bulb, you know, negative flash, you know, like that you would get, you know, I'm like, ah, Mickey, he's here. He's feeling it. Oh yeah. Look, I've felt these things, you know, we're playing Friend of the Devil in San Francisco. And I'm like, ah, fucking Jerry Garcia is right with me right now. You know, but it was like one of these moments, you know, and I'm like, I just like talk myself into this thing, you know, like, ah, Mickey Jones. I saw his spirit in this tungsten bulb flash while I was soloing, you know. I know I sound completely insane to you right now.
No, man. Sound like a musician. Keep going.
Okay, right on. And so, you know, same thing the next night. And I'm like, we're off to the next city, you know, and we finished our European tour. And I'm telling this story to everyone I know, you know, and about Mickey Jones and, mm-hmm. you know, channeling him and, you know, feeling like he was smiling, And then I find this Man bootleg that has that song that had that guitar solo I think it was footage of them live doing it. I'm like, oh, right. I've never seen this. And I play it and I'm watching it. And it's not Mickey Jones who was playing the guitar solo.
Oh, wow.
It's the other guitar player, Deke.
Oh, wow.
You know? So all these years, I've been like freaking out and, you know, freaking out enough to, you know, work myself up into this like supernatural frenzy, you know, but it wasn't even Mickey Jones. It was the other guitar player.
Yeah.
So there you have it, you know.
There you go. That's I love that, you know, that kind of disillusionment. I remember I had to break somebody's heart when I was explaining to them that it was Mick Taylor playing this thing that they thought was Keith Richards.
Hey, that's a good heartbreak right there.
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
In our age of disinformation, we got to get it right.
Man. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, yeah, these things.
Got to get the right ghost.
Great. You have a challenge though, which is, and I want to talk about in terms of like what you like in good guitar tones, which is that you've had to cope with amplifying acoustic instruments in electric settings and very loud ones for years, which always seems to be like the biggest compromise. I mean, through the you know, the
that's a real tricky thing. And, you know, so many people do have so many different ways of doing it. People, I'm still doing it the way I did it when I was with John Hiatt.
And what is that?
It was state of the art then, and it's definitely not what people do now. But, and, you know, it's not optimum. And if I was, playing solo acoustic guitar live, I might try and get into, you know, multi-mic'd. Like some people, even within Counting Crows, each of the guitar players does different things. But I just use a Fishman, you know, piezo pickup in the bridge. You know, no controls. Here's one thing. No controls on the acoustic guitar. No volume, no tone. Don't do anything to make you fuck it up. Just direct out. It's like a, you know, a Fender Esquire. Direct out, you know, from the pickup directly to the jack. It's from the piezo directly to the jack. None of this monkey business. No extra microphone in the body of the guitar. A lot of guys do that. They like to fuck around. Oh, balance the mic with the piezo pickup. Yeah. You know, great guitar players get great sounds, you know.
Yeah.
But more than anything for live, I like to keep it as simple as possible so that I don't distract myself. If you can understand that. You know, even with pedal boards and stuff, I just like to not have to think about things too much. It was like sort of like the Jerry Garcia thing about, oh, why do you always wear the black pocket tee? So I don't have to ever think about, ooh, I wore the wrong shirt at this
time. You know? It's in the same thing.
So same thing with the mandolin. The mandolin seems to sound good. I have changed preamps over the years. I used to use these Fishman blenders, but now I use what were originally bass DIs. Mm-hmm. These things called Evil Twin.
That's interesting.
But they turn out to be really, really fantastic. You know, I've been doing that for about 6 years, maybe longer. Did a shootout, and that turned out to be the best DI for acoustic guitars. I'm sure there's something out there now that's way beyond that. But I don't stay on top of it. If I've got something that works for me, I pretty much try and stay with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that works. I mean, if it works, I mean, you like it, it's good. You know, I was really wondering about that, of course, because once you're in the studio,
I have to fight with it. I have the benefit for the most part of having a monitor man. A consistent monitor man who we're always working on making it sound better on stage for me. And I'm one of the only people who still uses monitor wedges as opposed to in-ear monitors.
Oh, great.
In fact, I'm the only one in County Crows that does that. But luckily, the crew facilitates me.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, personally, I can understand why you do it. I always thought that though you get, you know, you're probably getting a sneer from people who like such controlled sound off of stages and whatnot. But
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's really interesting though. You know, I mean, I was speaking to a lot of people that are acoustic instrument players, you know, about the different ways that they go about that.
You can get really, really super deep into it, you know?
Yeah, I think I really can relate to the simplicity in all cases, you know, if you've got
it. Absolutely. Yeah, but that's just for me because I'm easily distracted and easily second guessed. And like I say, you know, I like to get out of, you know, I'm happiest when I'm able to get out of myself, you know.
Let's talk about your amplifier thing for guitar. I mean, your guitar sounds are just classic and beautiful. And
thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Got to be coming from I don't know what it is. It's like, you know, I don't actually know what you're using there, but I wonder about the amplifier choices. I mean, it's funny because I was talking to Adam Levy last week, and so, you know, different guitar players about things that go on with amplifiers and that, and I imagine you're very particular there, and that seems to be a place where you get a lot of sound variation. How do you go about picking what you want?
Well, you know, it depends on the situation. I have a lot of amps, and you know, I've had a lot of luck recording Counting Crows with this one particular Marshall. It's this weird sort of bootleg Blues Breaker combo, but it's not what it looks like. A blues breaker combo, it's 212 combo, right? Yeah. But it's fake. It's the head is like, I think, a 1968 Plexi head that was stuck into this fake Marshall combo. But it's just sure. For some reason, I've just had really good luck recording with it. I never use it live, but I record with that, with the Crows a lot over the last 10 years. Third Mind was exclusively this 1964 Fender Deluxe Reverb.
I think that's what I saw you playing in LA. You're just running your Strat into that.
When you came to that bar.
Piano bar, the clue.
I wound up using a boutique amp there a lot. Headstrong replication of a Deluxe Reverb or a.
Okay, it wasn't actually Deluxe.
Yeah. I try to use an amp of about that wattage in a club like that. You know, for Counting Crows, my main live amp is this 1963 Fender Pro Reverb. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a twin reverb, but half the power, so it breaks up. You know, and slightly different circuit, no middle control, and it just. This amp is just a workhorse, and it's just fantastic live, and for the kinds of places that County Crows play, I use that, and I have this Marshall combo that's sort of to get the Marshall-y sounds that I get out of that Marshall combo that I record with. I take that on the road with the Crows. So for the Crows, I have this Marshall 212 combo and that old Fender. But I've got a myriad of collection of amps, and it just depends on the situation. This one time, Monks of Doom record, this is a real revelation to me, by the way. And this was in the late 80s. Monks of Doom were making a record in San Francisco at this studio that we used a lot called Mobius. And the week before we went in, French Frith Kaiser Thompson went in and recorded a record there. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I don't know the band, but I know Kaiser and I know.
It's like Henry Kaiser, Fred Frith, Richard Thompson, and John French from Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band.
Okay, that was the name didn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
and so they were like this sort of indie super group. Musos, I shouldn't say, sure. I should say Musos supergroup, and they made a record there, and then they were, I saw them live and had my mind blown at this little club in Berkeley, and I'm a huge Richard Thompson fan, fan of everyone involved in that particular band, but I digress, they were recording the week before, and I was a real gearhead then, and just very worried about what gear I was bringing into the studio and stuff. And so I wanted to find out what Richard Thompson used. What did he do? What was he like in the studio? What did he bring to the studio? What amps did he bring? And the guy says, he didn't bring anything. He just showed up.
Well,
he used what was there. It's like, what? And that's kind of like how I am now too. It's like, I hope not to bring gear. I hope to try and make something happen with what's available. I love it when I shouldn't say that's how I am. I love it when that happens. And it was like a real, it's not about the gear.
Yeah.
It's about the mindset of the player.
Yeah, sure. It's about you. I mean, it's funny. I was talking to.
It's really easy to go down the gear wormhole. And I have a warehouse full of gear to prove that true. Uh-huh. But, it's a trap you can fall into too.
It seems like it. I mean, it's funny because I got it down to, it seemed like I was always looking around for years and years. And then I finally got it down to, basically I got the two amps I like, a small one and a slightly bigger one.
What are they?
I have a Victoria Double Deluxe. And I love that.
Okay, cool.
And just a Fender Blues Jr. basically.
Those are great amps actually.
Totally. And and they're set up right. And then and I'm down to just basically my 335 and a G&L Tele and you know, I did get a Collings guitar. Actually, this interview goes out to my friend. You know, they go on the site of my friend who's a Collings distributor. So I
Collings.
Yes, I have a Collings Electric that is just beautiful. I don't need to
what the 335 style or the Les
Paul? No, my 335 is actual 335. I have an arch. It's an arch top electric called an East Side. It's a Collings East Side.
I think I've seen those. Are they like big jazz guitar style?
They are, but it has this Charlie Christian pickup in a single Charlie Christian pickup mounted on it, and it sounds just it's basically. You know, it does that thing like, you know, it's just like the 50s thing where it goes from jazz to total R&B, you know.
Do you have a Collings acoustic guitar?
I do. I've had that since the 2000, probably the last time we hung out together.
Yeah. I remember playing your Collings and going, oh my God, I got to get one. I have several Collings that I want, you know, my main live acoustic guitar with the Crows is a Collings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great.
Huge fan of the acoustics.
They are amazing, and they've been getting better. Actually, the amazing thing is now it's like now I play them. Now I'm really my mouth is really watering. They got so good at building them.
Absolutely.
How do you get on with people you have to collaborate with or see what they want to do?
Again, I wish I could tell you that it was like, oh well, I read this book on self-actualization, and this is how you. You know, work musically with people. It's just organic, you know, it's just, I'm trying to get to the thing, you know, whatever, you know, and however we get there the quickest and easiest, you know, and I try and find people I've been fortunate to find people, who I just have some sort of simpatico with, you know, and you have the antenna on, you know. Keith Richards talks about having the antenna on to receive music, you know, and I don't know, you know, you find it in strange places, you know. I would say I have it with Duritz, you know. We've been doing shit for, you know, coming up on 40 years here, and you can just second guess people in a microscopic way, you know, musically. I have it with a bunch of, get along with drummers fairly well. So it's like, oh wow. If we can just feel like he knows where I'm going to be before I get there. That's what some people call that magic, you know? And you just try and do that. You just try and, I don't know, you know, it's not something I think about. It's something I think about after the fact more than anything else. Like, wow, that really worked. If it does work out with someone, it's like, oh, well, I'm going to keep playing with that person. You know, yeah. You can find yourself in situations where, Jesus, please don't. That person doesn't get invited to the next thing, or, you know, I don't want to find myself in a room trying to make music with that person again, you know? Sure. You know, like I say, when it does work, I try and facilitate repeating that, that experience. And that, so I've, over the decades, I've been fortunate to collect a lot of people that I play with that I get along with in that way. And I'm always trying to be sensitive to it. And when I find it, I don't take it for granted. You know, I will try and keep playing music with that person. I don't know if that answers the question, but I'm flattered to be talking to you. All right. Oh, I never read that one. I'll get on Amazon right after this call. Yeah. Yeah, he was in our world a bit for a little while there. He's a great guy, hilarious character. Were you ever into Shockabilly?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was a jazz record reviewer before anything, you know, for Downbeat, I want to say. He would review free jazz records and stuff, you know. No, sort of in the same way that Lenny Kaye was a record reviewer, you know. He sat in with the Monks of Doom a couple times, you know, and we do like, you know, he made records with Camper Van Beethoven, Camper Van Chadbourne records. I think he made a couple of those. I wasn't involved in those, but I was well aware of Eugene Chadbourne, Fred Frith, Henry Kaiser, that whole weird cadre of free guitar players. You know, Monks of Doom would go on tour and we'd stay at Eugene's house in Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, we'd crash at his place when we were in North Carolina. And, you know, he was always a very hospitable host. He'd come down to the gig, he'd sit in with us, you know. He told me he had this really, you know, and his, I don't think he lives there anymore, or maybe he does, I don't know. This is, again, this is in the 90s, early 90s. This one time we were staying at his house and his Jello Biafra had been staying there the week before we were there. He was on some spoken word tour. You know who I'm talking about? Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. So, and he was complaining about, oh God, fucking, I hate to talk shit about people, but Eugene was like, God, you guys are such great guests. Jello was such a drag, man. I'm like, what? You know? And he's like, oh God, he's just up in his own shit all the time. I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, wow, you know, like, you know, then the bathroom to the guest room was, you know, we were in the room and the bathroom was right there where guests would take showers. And like I'd walk by the bathroom and he'd be in the shower and like, you know, dictating to himself. I'd hear him in the shower with his handheld tape recorder, click, idea. And then he'd start, you know, it was like, it was never just let it go for a second. You know, I was like, anyway. Eugene was very, very, very funny guy. Well, movies, Well, look, my dad was from Vienna, you know, and my mom's Canadian. So I'm like, I'm first generation American, and I was sort of brought up in the European tradition and exposed to a lot of stuff. And, you know, Berkeley was a great place to grow up in the, you know, 70s and 60s, 70s and 80s. There was a movie theater there that was a repertory theater that, you know, change movies every day, and you know, curated by film buffs. So there'd be a Fellini festival that would go on for 2 months, and every Wednesday you would see two Fellini movies. You know that you'd be doing that. You know, and you know, just you know, that kind of exposure outside of music, the Beatniks. You know. A great literary tradition as well. I mean, for God's sake, Ginsberg got busted for reading Howl at the First Unitarian Church in Berkeley, is where the famous arrest was, you know. So you just, you know, you grow up with these, you know, required reading, you know, in the Bay Area. So I don't know, I guess, you know, you got to entertain yourself somehow. And just like, I love music so much and I love knowing all these different, just getting into all this different kind of music, you know? I mean, I want to talk about food, man. I want to talk about Giacomo's, for fuck's sake. No.
Of course, of course.
And thanks a lot. It's been great talking to you. So and hearing you again.
We got to do it more often. I always feel at these things like, wow, did I say anything? Did we cover any ground?
I think it does.
Did you get what you needed? Did you get what you wanted?
I'm interested in talking about music with musicians. I think a lot of times people get, you can really get stuck on the wrong subject with a lot of kind of interviews where they're, where you don't get to really see what people's music life is. So I think
what do you mean by like, for example,
I think there's a lot of superficial interviewing that goes on that doesn't really deal with the drives of musicians or what it's like to be engaging with a musical life. And I think that I think that misses a lot of it and actually creates a disinterest for people because it makes them just go into it like you're somebody just purveying a product. And I think a lot of interviews are designed that are somewhat structured that way, And so I try to avoid that because, I think the variation of all the different kinds of music voices that I talk to, which are, they're not all the same, but they are all an engagement with musical life, an individual one. And so
that's a really cool thing. I mean, that's what it's all about, engaging, trying to figure out how to engage with the musical life.
And I think that's interesting.
I guess I'm pretty sure we covered that subject.
Totally. Absolutely, amongst others. So I think it's great. Yeah. So if you're satisfied, I am.
I hope to see you sooner than later, Jonathan.
Likewise, David. Let's hope this thing frees up so that we can all travel again.
I mean, let me know when you put this together so I can hear how insane I sound.
Absolutely. It'll be pretty soon. So great. Right. You take care of yourself. Thanks for taking care, brother.
I'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Banjo Studio Podcast with your host, Jonathan Frelick. Head over to banjostudio.com for a great selection of American-made banjos and Collings guitars.